content of this program is intended for a blind or print-impaired audience. Hello, Michael Blakely here with Religion in the News. For the next 28-odd minutes, I'll be reading articles from various news services on the subject of religion. From The Economist, first of March 2nd, The Abrahamic Faiths, How Three Men of Different Beliefs Are Advocating Religious Tolerance. After nearly 17 years on the road, the Interfaith Amigos, or a trio, an imam, a rabbi, and a Christian pastor, to be precise, well-versed in America's religious scene. Based in Seattle, they have given hundreds of presentations to audiences across the country, and a few in Canada, Japan, and the Middle East. With a mixture of exhortation, mild provocation, and humor, they urge people to think differently about religions, both their own and those of others. It started in the aftermath of the 9/11 terror attacks, when Rabbi Ted Falcon invited Jamal Rahman, an imam who practices Sufism, to join a Jewish Shabbat service, quote, because people had to see a different face of Islam. Then they were joined by the Reverend Don McKenzie, a Protestant minister, and they became a kind of traveling troika. In between fooling around on stage with his old friends and exchanging wisecracks about whitening hair, the rabbi notices several almost contradictory trends in religious America. On one hand, the general mood of nationalism and nativism seems to have triggered a rise in anti-Jewish and anti-Muslim sentiment. At a minimum, followers of those faiths feel more nervous about being stigmatized for their beliefs. On the other hand, the emergence of spiritual but not religious as an ever more popular metaphysical stance means that lots of people now admit to not knowing much about any of the Abrahamic faiths, either their differences or commonalities. In their more serious moments, the trio try to suggest new ways of looking at holy texts and traditions, including the parts which appear to enjoin violence or intolerance. As Rabbi Falcon puts it, sacred writ contains passages of universal, eternal importance, as well as statements that responded to particular historical circumstances, like the needs of a nomadic people in the distant past. People have to be helped to make that distinction. That may be a commonplace of liberal academic theology, but putting it over snappily to a non-specialist audience needs practice. Without being too somber, the three speakers also set out to hone their listeners' sensitivities by challenging them to remember times when they felt close to the divine and encouraging them to use simple spiritual exercises. It does not convince everybody. During one presentation at Western Washington University, a fundamentalist Christian wagged his finger at Imam Rahman and said the Quran gave people permission, in some circumstances, to lie. Although the Quran has a lot to say against lying, there is a verse, 16:106, which is read to mean that believers will not be condemned if they hide their faith under duress. But free-willing religious debate can take unexpected turns. A Jewish listener also stood up and asked a rhetorical question. Imagine living in Nazi Germany in a home where Jews were being secretly sheltered. How would you answer a question about their presence in the house? His point drew loud applause. The trio, with second pastor Dave Brown, sometimes standing in for Mr. McKenzie, like to start their presentation with the simple statement that life is difficult. That is the opening line of a classic work of self-help, The Road Less Traveled, and it enables the author, Scott Peck, to explain that many people either underestimate or overestimate the challenges of daily existence according to their own neuroses. For Seattle's monotheistic threesome, Peck's homely adage leads into a chat about how negotiating problems, including those caused by religious rivalries, is a path to spiritual growth. In some ways, life in Donald Trump's America is getting even more difficult for people such as the Interfaith Amigos, who try to tackle religious difference with sophistication and humor. but the number of invitations they receive is on the rise. Imam Rahman thinks this could reflect some people's feeling that, quote, we have no choice but to cooperate and collaborate because it is now a matter of survival. One of his favorite lines on stage is, we are cousins, part of the same Abrahamic family, but a very, very dysfunctional Abrahamic family. And now to the Religion News Service of March 1st. A first edition Book of Mormon sells at auction for $80,000. In a nail-biting, down-to-the-wire bidding war, a version of a book that can be had for free in many hotel rooms was sold this week at auction for $80,000. A first edition of the Book of Mormon, the founding text of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, was auctioned by EBTH, an online auction house. The starting bid was $1, but in the final 15 minutes of the week-long auction were punctuated by rapidly rising bids in mostly $500 increments. While not a record for a first edition Book of Mormon, that was set at $180,000 in 2007, it is almost double the price for another first edition Book of Mormon sold in 2014, and significantly higher than another one sold for $52,000 in 2016. The winning bidder was a private collector, according to EBTH. The first edition, printed in 1830, is most precious to members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints because Joseph Smith, the faith's founder, personally oversaw its production in a small storefront printer's shop in Palmyra, New York. Thousands of Mormons visit a restored version of the shop in Palmyra each year. Appraising another first edition of the Book of Mormon for Antiques Roadshow in 2013, rare book specialist Ken Sanders said, it isn't technically the rarest of the editions of the Book of Mormon, but for LDS people, it's the one that everybody knows and understands and wants. Last year, the Community of Christ, which traces its roots to Smith, sold the printer's manuscript of the first edition of the Book of Mormon to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints for $35 million, the highest price ever paid for a religious manuscript. The volume auctioned this week is one of 5,000 copies in that first edition. It was bound in pigskin and sold for between $1.25 and $1.75 in the printer's store. 2 weeks after its publication, Smith, a farmer who claimed an angel gave him golden plates from which he translated the Book of Mormon, organized what would eventually become the LDS Church. Today, the LDS Church has 15.8 million members worldwide, and its missionaries have distributed, for free, more than 150 million copies of the Book of Mormon to date. And now from the Associated Press of March 1st on the Catholic Church, a Vatican magazine has denounced how nuns are often treated like indentured servants by cardinals and bishops, for whom they cook and clean for next to no pay. The March edition of Women Church World, the monthly women's magazine of the Vatican newspaper L'Osservatore Romano, hit newsstands Thursday, on March 1st, its expose on the underpaid labor and unappreciated intellect of religious sisters confirmed that the magazine is increasingly becoming the imprint of the Church's Me Too movement. Quote, some of them serve in the homes of bishops or cardinals, others work in the kitchens of church institutions or teach. Some of them, serving the men of the church, get up in the morning to make breakfast and go to sleep after dinner is served, the house cleaned, and the laundry washed and ironed, reads one of the lead articles. A nun, identified only as Sister Marie, describes how sisters serve clergy but are rarely invited to sit at the tables they serve. While such servitude is common knowledge, it is remarkable that an official Vatican publication would dare put such words into paper and publicly denounce how the Church systematically exploits its own nuns. But that pluck has begun to define Women Church World. which launched 6 years ago as a monthly insert in L'Osservatore Romano, and is now a standalone magazine distributed for free online and alongside the printed newspaper in Italian, Spanish, French, and English. "Until now, no one has had the courage to denounce these things," said the magazine's editor, Lucetta Scarafia, to the Associated Press. "We try to give a voice to those who don't have the courage to say these words publicly." "Inside the church, women are exploited," she said in a recent interview. While Pope Francis has told Scarafia he appreciates and reads the magazine, it is by no means beloved within the deeply patriarchal Vatican system. Recent issues have raised eyebrows, including the March 2016 edition on Women Who Preach, which appeared to advocate allowing lay women to deliver homilies at Mass. One of the authors had to publish a subsequent clarification saying he didn't mean to suggest a change to existing doctrine or practice. Other recent issues have explored the symbolic power of women's bodies and rape as torture. Scarafia, a Catholic feminist and professor of history at Rome's La Sapienza University, sees the magazine as a necessary tool to push the envelope on issues that matter to half the members of the Catholic Church. "The fact that a women's supplement to L'Osservatore Romano is even necessary is indicative of what she's up against." L'Osservatore is the official newspaper of the Vatican, publishing official papal decrees and speeches, and maintaining an editorial line that reflects the priorities of the Holy See. The March issue of its women's magazine was dedicated to women and work, and explores many issues that are in some ways correlated to the Me Too movement, including the gender pay gap, the lack of women in leadership positions, and the Ni Una Menos movement to combat feminicide and violence against women, often by spurned lovers. During his recent trip to Peru, Francis denounced feminicide and gender-based crimes that have turned his home continent, Latin America, into the most violent place on earth for women. He also has frequently called for dignified work and dignified pay for all. And in a recent prologue to a book on women's issues, Francis acknowledged that he was concerned that in many cases, women's work in the church is sometimes more servitude than service. The March edition of Women Church World drives that home with a lead article, "The Nearly Free Work of Sisters," by French journalist Marie-Lucille Kabaki, the Rome correspondent for La Vie magazine of Le Monde Group. Kabaki noted that sisters often work for prelates or church institutions without contracts. When one falls sick, she is simply sent back to her congregation, which sends another in her place. Other sisters, meanwhile, show remarkable intellectual gifts and earn advanced degrees, but aren't allowed to put them to use because the collective nature of religious communities often discourages personal advancement, said another nun, Sister Paul, to the magazine. Behind all this, is the unfortunate idea that women are worth less than men, and above all, that priests are everything in the church while sisters are nothing. Sister Marie noted that many nuns from Africa, Asia, or Latin America who come to study in Rome hail from poor families whose extended care is often paid for by their congregations. As a result, they feel they can't complain about their work conditions, she said. This all creates in them a strong interior rebellion, Sister Marie reported. These sisters feel indebted, tied down, and so they keep quiet. Scarafia said she wanted to give these sisters a voice, even though she counts herself among the churches exploited. Neither Scarafia nor the 8-member editorial staff of Women Church World is paid. The magazine, funded by a grant from the Italian postal service Poste Italiane, pays contributors for their articles, but it is published each month thanks to the free labor of its editorial staff. And from the Guardian now of March 2nd, Anglicanism. The Church of England faces, quote, deep shame at child abuse inquiry. The Church of England is braced for 2 years of deep shame over its handling of child sex abuse cases, with allegations of cover-ups, collusion, and callous treatment of survivors under scrutiny from Monday at the UK's biggest public inquiry. The Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, will be cross-examined in person during 3 weeks of hearings this month. Two former archbishops, serving bishops, and other senior church figures are also to give evidence or submit witness statements to the Independent Inquiry into Child Sexual Abuse, IICSA. Further hearings will follow in July and next year. Survivors of sexual abuse are expected to accuse the church of failing to act on disclosures and failing to treat them with compassion. Their lawyers are likely to call for independent oversight of the C of E's safeguarding processes, claiming that the church has shown itself incapable of dealing properly with allegations and disclosures. Welby himself has said the church must acknowledge where it went wrong. "We failed really badly around the issues to the care of children and vulnerable adults. We have to face the consequences of that and learn to be transparent and honest and genuinely repentant," he recently told reporters. Peter Hancock, the Bishop of Bath and Wells, and the C of E's lead bishop on safeguarding, who will also give evidence, told The Guardian he expected to feel a deep, deep sense of shame during the hearings. The church had cooperated fully with the IICSA, but the inquiry would ask challenging questions, and I don't run from that, Hancock said. The church needed to learn, and that meant not just new policies, but new courage and resolve to change. As well as Welby and Hancock, among those expected to give evidence, either in person or by written statement, are former Archbishops of Canterbury Rowan Williams and George Carey, and the current Bishop of Chichester, Martin Warner. In preparation for the hearings, the church has submitted more than 25,000 documents and 36 witness statements. This month's hearing will focus on abuse in the Diocese of Chichester, where there have been multiple allegations of sexual abuse, some dating back many years. The church's handling of a controversial abuse allegation made against George Bell, the former Bishop of Chichester who died 60 years ago, will be examined. But the issue is far from historical. In 2016, the C of E was dealing with more than 2,600 reports of sexual abuse within its parishes, with more than 700 relating to church officers. As well as hearing accounts of abuse from survivors, the inquiry is also expected to be told of the secondary abuse experienced by many at the hands of church figures who allegedly ignored, disparaged, or covered up their disclosures. The church is guilty of two distinct crimes, cover-up and its treatment of survivors, said the Reverend Graham Sawyer, a survivor who gave evidence against Peter Ball, the former Bishop of Gloucester, jailed in October 2015 for sexual abuse. The corporate narcissism and hubris of the C of E's leadership has meant they've made horrendous mistakes. The hearings are going to be immensely uncomfortable for the church, but the key question is whether they will bring about change. G. Lowe, another survivor, said of the C of E hierarchy was, quote, likely to go into meltdown in the coming weeks and months. The damage is self-inflicted and centers around denial and dishonesty across the top of the church. The public imagines that cover-up is the thing of the past. I'm not so sure. I suspect we'll see senior figures in difficulty. There are likely to be resignations. The C of E will need a reboot at the end of all this. He hoped that the hearings would, quote, shine a spotlight on a broken culture and usher in a legal requirement to report abuse disclosures to the police. I do not expect the C of E will look the same in a year's time. If it does, then IICSA will not have achieved much. Richard Scorer, a specialist abuse lawyer at Slater & Gordon, said these hearings were likely to be highly damaging for the church. They will expose the mistreatment and denigration of victims, which happened over many years, and the culture of abuse, which was prevalent in the Chichester diocese and the church generally. They will expose the cover-up of abuse allegations in relation to Peter Ball and many other cases. The fundamental problem for the C of E in dealing with abuse was that bishops were not accountable, he said. A bishop is king in his diocese. If a bishop is resistant to safeguarding, there's no real way to overcome this. We need external oversight of safeguarding and external handling of complaints and mandatory reporting of all allegations to police and social services. Until these are put in place, the church will continue to have a serious problem. Unfortunately, the church is currently unwilling to face up to this reality. The church says it has professionalized its safeguarding processes and acknowledges it needs to strengthen its response to survivors. Safeguarding officials see the IICSA hearings as an opportunity to learn from past mistakes with humility and courage. Alan Wilson, the Bishop of Buckingham, who has pressed for a cultural change within the Church on Abuse, said the IICSA hearings would only examine the tip of a large iceberg. He added, "The inquiry has promised to go beyond individual failures and the processes by which they were handled and examine habits, attitudes, and beliefs that made them so possible and pervasive. An ounce of culture is worth a ton of policy." And back to the Economist now of February 25th. Refugees, Christianity, and Europe. Christian responses to the migrant crisis have been radical and traditional. Churches often provide shelter, but what more should they be doing? Across most of Europe, a majority of people declare some loose attachment to Christianity, while a much smaller percentage actively follow that faith. As a result, churches and their adherents have some influence over European affairs. People expect them to react when the continent is faced with some great moral challenge, such as the recent desperate influx of migrants by sea and land. Ghastly as they have been, the human consequences of that influx would surely have been worse still without the efforts of churches and religious charities to help destitute newcomers. Across Germany, nearly 400 churches have provided shelter for migrants who fear deportation. But what else should Europe's Christians do or say? In almost every European country, there exist hard-line political movements whose declared aim is to protect the continent's Christian heritage against alien influences. Religious leaders generally regard these parties as embarrassments, or worse. Even when you move a bit closer to the respectable mainstream, there are as many shades of opinion in European Christianity as there are denominations. That emerged in the glorious diversity of a gathering earlier this week in the Greek city of Thessaloniki, hosted by Dutch and Greek think tanks, and at which your blogger co-chaired a session, where views ranging from the radical to the traditional. Broadly, their task was to look at Europe's economic and refugee crisis from a Christian point of view. According to Ulrich Duckrau, a theology professor emeritus from Germany's Heidelberg University, Christians ought to protest at the American-led interference in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Libya, which he sees as the main drivers of the migration crisis. In this fiery octogenarian's view, churches and migrants should join secular radicals to challenge Western foreign policy. Above all, he claims, churches should be steering their flock away from xenophobes who see migrants as the enemy. One of the continent's few transnational Christian political groups voiced different ideas. The European Christian Political Movement, ECPM, speaks for small, socially conservative parties across the continent urging pro-family policies and opposing the march of federal power in the European Union. It has half a dozen representatives in the European Parliament who line up with the British Conservatives. In the spirit of anti-federalism, it defends the right of Central European countries to limit the intake of migrants. Migration, like national security, should be a matter of sovereign governments, as it insists. Paul Mills, a British economist and church elder who is close to the ECPM's thinking, said spiritual principles should transform the relationship between the EU's rich heartland and its poor periphery. The aim should be a healthy market based on law, transparency, and the avoidance of extreme inequality. Transactions between the continent and new arrivals should also be fair and contractual and include the migrant's duty to obey the host country's laws. Salux, a Dutch think tank linked to the ECPM, saw some hope in the emergence in bits of northern Syria of a de facto administration where Arabs, Kurds, Muslims, and Christians could live together with a degree of religious freedom. People were less likely to flee from such places, it believed. Other speakers came with a specific worry. The fate of the small share of migrants who profess or convert to non-Muslim faiths, including Christianity. Such newcomers are often harassed on reaching their destination by fellow refugees who followed Islam, and UN agencies took little count of this, several speakers said. A vote in the Dutch parliament had told the government to pay more attention to religious and sexual minorities among migrants, but those who identify as Christian faced harsh questioning from Dutch officials about their religious history, said a lawyer from the Stichtingave, a legal watchdog. Non-Muslim refugees were often wary of telling their story through Muslim interpreters, he and others noted. For the Greek clerical hosts, the whole gathering was an unusual experience. As was noted by one clerical academic, when the Greek Orthodox Church raised its voice, it is often in defense of its own interests or other national questions, like who has the historic right to use the name Macedonia. People admire the role of Greek Orthodox parishes, along with the country's tiny Catholic and Protestant minorities, in providing basic aid to newcomers and needy locals. But the church has not done very much to analyze the root causes of economic crisis or speak truth about corruption, say, to political power. That may change, according to a booklet circulated at the conference. In it, Bishop Ignatius of Demetrios, who runs a theological academy, notes that the crisis-stricken Greek state has less money now to pay Orthodox clergy, who are mostly civil servants. Far from harming the church, he thinks this could force Orthodox Christians, clergy and laity, to find their own feet, rely less on state largesse, and become more independent. If Greece's national church overheeds that advice and decides to speak more freely on matters like economics and migration, Christian Europe's infinite variety will offer it plenty of ideological positions to choose from. Well, that's all the time we have now for Religion in the News. This has been Michael Lickley. I'll talk to you later.